You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a overcast, gloomy Davis day. But you know, Don, I know we're going to get a week of rain. I know that. We're going to get sunshine a week from today.
We are going into a different temperature range for the last week. Yeah. It's been sunny and temperatures were in the 60s and everybody was coming in shorts and shirt sleeves because this is Davis, California, where everybody wears those as soon as the sun comes out. And they're looking for summer vegetables and flowers and things like that. And now we have this week. Lois and I are preparing this show on March 12th, 2025 for broadcast on March 13th. Our high today is going to be 56 degrees with a chance of showers and then pretty firm showers this evening, showers likely through the night, a low of 42 degrees. Last week, just a few days ago, we got to 31.5 degrees east of Dixon. Okay, now you didn't get that cold in town. You only got to 35 or 36 degrees. But bear in mind, that's a little cold for summer vegetables. Thursday is going to be 56 degrees, chance of showers. Thursday night, 39 degrees. Remember, 39 degrees, chance of showers. Friday, the high is going to be 51 degrees, showers and breezy. Friday night, 40, chance of showers and mostly cloudy. Saturday, mostly sunny, 60 degrees. Saturday night, 41 degrees, slight chance of showers. Sunday, chance of showers mainly after 11 a.m. Sort of a series of small storms passing over us. It'll be mostly cloudy on Sunday with a high near 62. Sunday night, showers again, mostly cloudy with a low around 44. Showers likely Monday, high near 60. Tuesday, high near 62. None of these storms are going to give us all that much except the one that we're going to be experiencing today, the day before the broadcast, when they're talking about half to three quarters of an inch of rain and pretty gusty winds tonight. This storm is going to move in pretty windy and maybe another quarter of inch overnight. And then basically each of these storms passing through a tenth of an inch, they're not even giving me numbers on the later storms during the week. So this is the kind where I say this is really more fungus weather than irrigation weather, sad to say. But those temperatures are low. Those temperatures at night are getting down 40, a little below 40. So it's still too cold for all those summer vegetables to even really be out on display at garden centers, much less in the ground at your home. Needless to say, the most common question we're getting nowadays as people walk into the nursery is,
is it time to plant tomatoes?
There you go.
You know, we haven't answered it. We'll come right back to the weather. I want to pop out of this for just a second.
Okay.
We have a listener, Gordon, who lives up in Quebec, Canada.
Yes.
And he listens to our show and he likes it. And he says, so here he sent us a picture of his road in front of his house. And there is a snowbank that is taller than a human being. And he writes, his email says, good morning. Here is the photographic answer to that eternal question. Is it time to plant tomatoes yet? It could be a few more weeks.
Not in Quebec. It is worth noting that the further north you go in latitude, the faster your days increase in day length and sunlight and all that kind of stuff. But I'm guessing, Gordon, you're probably 6 to 8 weeks out up there. I'm thinking Memorial Day weekend is probably your busy planning period for summer vegetables. It's also not time here. And this is my concern on this. I've brought in some and we have a little pop-up greenhouse at our garden center. And if you walk in, there's a little sign taped to the greenhouse, which is not really for the public, but there's a sign that says tomato plants available in greenhouse, ask for assistance. We thought this was a subtle way of saying, it's too early for these to be out here. We can't really leave them out in the nursery yard overnight, much less have you take them home and put them in the ground. Temperatures in the 30s are definitely going to affect them. It's not a heated greenhouse, but it does get, you know, good sunlight during the daytime. So in that greenhouse, the daytime temperature is in the mid 80s. This is one of the big advantages of these little pop-up greenhouses everybody likes to use. They extend the season. So while the nights are getting colder than I prefer, the daytime, it gets really warm in there, and that tends to make up for it. My concern is this. I've got lists from three different vendors that I buy tomatoes and peppers and things like that from. Each of them now has at least two dozen varieties of tomatoes on their list, ready to send out to garden centers and hardware stores all over Northern California. They even have peppers. They have squash, cucumbers, melons. If the average garden center brings those in and puts them out on open benches that are open to the sky, the plants will be affected by that. They will be somewhat stunted by it. The tomatoes, yeah, I know that they'll recover. So it's not that big an issue necessarily, but they're already turning kind of purplish because of a phosphorus deficiency in the plant that's related to the temperatures affecting the uptake of phosphorus. They're not going to grow much. They're basically not ready to go in the ground, and they could be adversely affected, setting them back. In the case of peppers and eggplant and things like that, they'll be set back all season. So if I were giving you my best advice about your impulsive buying habits, I would, it's okay to buy the tomatoes and do the things we talk about, shifting them into bigger pots, putting them on a warm patio or near your house or something like that. Don't buy, I hate to say this, I'm a retailer. Don't buy the peppers. Don't buy the eggplants. Wait, they'll be red, and especially don't buy cucumbers or melons, or even squash, because they will be adversely affected and it will affect them all season. It'll set them back significantly. And they'll be there in a month when it's the appropriate time to plant them. So as we say at our garden center, and I'll just leave it at this, for best results, we plant tomatoes in April, peppers and eggplants in May. For best results in Quebec, you probably plant tomatoes in May.
Wait till the snow melts.
You plant tomatoes in May and probably peppers and eggplant in early June. I am told by people who garden in such climates that Memorial Day weekend is kind of your big planting time. If you're in one of those regions, you can certainly send us a note at davisgardenshow@gmail.com. Show us your snowbanks and tell us what your typical planting season is. Here, for tomatoes and a lot of other things, April is great. I'll have loads of pepper of tomatoes coming in the first week of April, even though I still think it's typically too cold for best results. At least you're not harming them at that point. And for the peppers and eggplant, May. There's a bunch of other rules you can find at redwoodbarn.com. You know, what the night temperature should be, 50 degrees. Whether we've hit 80 degrees during the daytime is a pretty easy metric, you know, because that tells you we're getting there, what the soil temperature is, and so forth. We have all that information. We, of course, go over that a lot. But the really simple rule of thumb, for best results, tomatoes in April, peppers and eggplants in May, remembering that we're in USDA zone 9. Okay, shall we get back to the weather?
Let's go back and finish the weather off.
Yeah, we've got cold weather. We've got chance of showers. Regrettably, when we're talking about just showers and then days hitting around 60 degrees, we do start getting into various fungus problems. Some of them were pre-existing, like peach leaf curl. Others, people have been asking me about fire blight. So let's talk about those two in particular. Peach leaf curl is already infecting, if it's going to, because that infects the new growth as the buds break and the growth pushes out. I showed Lois a picture of one of my, it's actually a nectar plum in bloom. It's a beautiful plant. And the leaves are already showing the early symptoms of peach leaf curl, the leaves that have already emerged. There's nothing to do about peach leaf curl once the buds have broken and the growth is beginning. It's already infected. You'll get that primary infection, which is the main one we're concerned about, where a fair number of the leaves, anywhere from 10% to 90%, depending on the year, the weather, the time that the buds break, the variety, and so forth, will be affected, and the leaves will get buckled and distorted. It's one of the most visible and rather grotesque diseases that we get in the family orchard. You spray for it before the buds break. So in March, it's too late here in Northern California to spray for peach leaf curl. There's nothing to be done about peach leaf curl once the plant has started to grow. And you'll just wait it out and the plant will outgrow it. I guarantee it. Many people spray and prevent some percentage of the leaves being infected. Other people don't spray and they get more peach leaf curl. In any case, the peaches and nectarines will outgrow it.
So when they, when they do outgrow it and the new leaves come out without the peach leaf curl, at forcing the what did you call buckled ones?
Sure, infected leaves. Yeah, yeah.
Now, at that point, are the leaves that have fallen off and are so funny looking, are they infectious? Should we like try and gather up those leaves and destroy them?
They do not appear to be a significant source of infection or reinfection. We get primary and secondary infections of peach leaf curl here. The primary one is the one that infects as the leaf is pushing out and it's still very tiny. So a very small amount of infection can cause a significant amount of symptom. So the whole leaf will be distorted. By the way, it's still photosynthesizing. I mean, it's still feeding the plant, but it's very distorted and it tends to fall off. So the question always comes up, should I pick off the leaves? It would probably prevent maybe some of the secondary infection, although I don't actually think so. I'll come back to that in a moment. The secondary infection is if we get rain and the leaves are pushing out, there's soft, tender growth, and we get a rainstorm and the spores splash onto the new leaves that are pushing out, you'll get areas of buckling and distortion on an otherwise normal looking leaf. So a leaf will look fine, but a little side of it will be distorted. That's the secondary infection. In a really wet year, such as we encounter during El Nino years, for example, we're out of El Nino now, but we were for a couple of years, you'll even get a third infection. I believe, based on what I've read, that infection is coming from leaf curl spores, if you will, that were on the wood, not on the newly infected leaves. I don't think it spreads from the new leaves from the infected leaves to the new leaves. I think it spreads from the bark to the new leaves, I believe. I'm not 100% sure on that. So if you're a peach leaf curl scientist, send me your published data and I'd be more than happy to talk about it. We do know a lot about peach leaf curl. And we know that the temperature range for leaf infection is different than the temperature range for blossom infection, that we almost never see impact here in USDA Zone 9, lowland parts of California or other similar climates. We almost see no impact on the blossom or really from a home garden standpoint on the fruit quality or yield. So it's not that big an issue for us, although commercially they, of course, would want all their fruit to look perfect and as much yield as possible. I've never seen impact of peach leaf curl on the fruit itself. So the main concern people have is that a lot of leaves are really distorted in a bad year, and a lot of those leaves fall off, which theoretically weakens the plant. My answer to that is get the tree on a good rootstock, such as Lovell or one of the other normal rootstocks, avoid the semi-dwarf rootstock cytation, and the plant will simply outgrow it. And I've taken many pictures of this. I'll go out probably in a week or two, take pictures of leaf curl. I'll mark the spot. I'll go back 4 weeks later, take my phone in the exact same spot, take a picture of the same volume of leaves, and you'll find that the new growth has simply replaced the infected leaves. So many people stopped spraying years ago when the effective control measures went away. And guess what? We still get perfectly good peaches and nectarines and large numbers of them. Picking off the leaves is probably a pointless exercise. So if someone tells you to do that, they are probably just making work for you. Okay. Once again, many of us like to give you busy work. As far as I'm concerned, my attitude is completely the opposite. If you can grow them without doing something, so much the better, because I think people will be happier gardeners if they don't have to go out there and pick off infected leaves from their peach tree.
So I know what peach leaf curl looks like because I've had it.
Recognizable, yeah.
When I had a peach tree.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are there other things that will curl up peach leaves that people might confuse with peach leaf curl?
First of all, peaches and nectarines both get peach leaf curl, and only peaches and nectarines and their relatives get peach leaf curl. So other stone fruits do not get peach leaf curl. Plums get curled up leaves right after the peach leaf curl typically is affecting and has kind of run its course, and then the new growth on your plums is all distorted. Just open one of those leaves up and look in the inside and you'll see what's causing that. It's aphids. Aphids are common. There's a particular one that gets on plums and pluots and to some degree apricots, and causes usually about a foot of the growth in April to have the leaves all curled up and distorted. And then the tree just outgrows it. And this is a case where the aphid population shows up, increases rapidly. If you do nothing, I can tell you in about 4 weeks, something will come along and start controlling them. The parasitic wasps that parasitize them, the beneficials like lacewings and leatherwing beetles, and to some degree ladybird beetles, ladybugs will come in and feed on them. And I've never seen the aphid problem on plums continue all season. It's just a case where you get about a 4-week population cycle and it just outgrows it. And it doesn't affect the fruit, the quality or anything, or the vigor of the tree. So people often think that their peaches have peach leaf curl, but the only things that can get peach leaf curl are peaches and nectarines. So that's an easy one to answer.
So we have been distracted yet again, Don. Can we go back to the weather?
No, we're going to talk about fire blight now. So the next question that came up, was, it's going to rain. What about fire blight? Well, the good news there is the temperatures are too low for fire blight to be a big problem yet. Fire blight is something that affects apples, pears, and members of that branch of the rose family. So things in the genus Malus, Pyrus, and then quince, which are related. Loquat, regrettably, is very susceptible to fire blight. And some ornamental plants that we grow, some of the hawthorns, cotoneasters, or pyracanthas can get fire blight. They're members of the pome group of the rose family. Roses don't get it. Stone fruits like peaches, nectarines don't get it. Just members of that division, the pome group, the apple group. And we're too cold for fire blight right now. My regular apples are just about to bloom, 55 to 82 degrees. It's such a specific temperature range. I'll never forget that. I'm thinking, sitting there in plant pathology class going, that seems very precise. What happens at 83 degrees? What about 53 degrees? My father taught me as a research scientist years ago, you hear a very precise statistic, be dubious. But in that range, mid 50s to low 80s is the temperature range. And if we're dropping below 55 at night, night after night, fire blight is unlikely to establish. It's having a conversation with a customer who's also a listener. You know, the apples are about to open. You know, is this a concern for infection? Not presently. What happens is the bacteria splashes on there, much like peach leaf curl. It has to either splash or a bee carries it into the bloom, and it just can't infect. It's not that the spores aren't there. It just doesn't infect at those temperatures. It's immobilized, or its life cycle is slowed down to the point it can't get a foothold, can't infect. So once we warm up with apples blooming, fire blight co-evolved with apple and pear trees. They bloom in April, typically late March into April. That's fire blight season. It's about a 4-week period, end of March into the middle of April, that we can get fire blight. So the good news is it's not happening yet. The bad news is there's still really no control for fire blight. So I don't have a spray for you, even if you wanted to do one. There's some things labeled for it, which in my opinion simply don't work. If anybody claims a particular product does, please ask to see the efficacy data, because I tell you, I've looked at all of it. And for home gardeners, there really isn't much out there that works for fire blight, except to let it run its course, prune it out either at the time it's infecting very carefully, or better yet, just let it run its course, go in when we're past fire blight season, prune it all out later. So fire blight is going to be a couple weeks from now. We'll let you know when fire blight occurs, but that's the other thing people are asking about. And the third one would be brown rot on plums and apricots. And that is a concern. If you've had it in the past, you can spray for that, although it's a spray you're going to do when the trees are blooming. You're going to use copper when the trees are in bloom. Or just prune your trees so they're more open, so you get better air circulation. That's probably the simplest thing for a home gardener to do about brown rot. KDRT is community radio. That's public radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. If you like what you hear, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. And while you're over there, take a look at the schedule of programming here at KDRT. It changes every few months. So if there's a favorite show, you might want to see when the replay is presently broadcast. And there are new shows that have been showing up. We have one called That California Sound, which features local, regional, and small touring bands making their way through California. The show highlights the history and culture of California musicians, venues, teachers, recording studios, promoters, festivals, and general resources that enrich our community. John is the programmer there. That California Sound is live Wednesdays, 3 to 4 p.m. For the rebroadcast time for all the programming here, just click on the schedule guide. All right, now we have another unhappy thing to talk about, which is a bug.
I still have a question about the weather.
Okay.
Weather.
Okay.
All right. So it is March. The sun is, in our latitude, is rising higher and higher each day. And the days are getting longer. So if you may not have heard this, listeners, but I had xylosma bushes in my backyard that were maybe, oh, I don't know, 16 or more feet tall. And when I say bush, it really is a one-trunked bush. It's a tree until it gets up there and goes fluffy. So I had someone come and cut them down to 8 feet. There's not much there. There's like this trunk, this stub, but it's 8 feet tall. And my question is, it's a xylosma. I know it's going to break new things coming out of the buds that are in there. I know that I've done that before. Do I have to worry about painting the trunks of a xylosma?
Generally, no. The trunk color can be a good guide. Is this a trunk color, bark color that reflects sunlight or absorbs it? So our
It's
concern,
medium gray.
yeah, so it'll reflect it. So basically, it functions already in terms of reducing sunburn. The concern with opening up wood that was not previously exposed is you might get sunburn and you might get borers. So question we have is, what's the color of the bark, and is this a plant that's susceptible to borers? Xylosma, in general, as of this time in Northern California, is not susceptible to borers. Back in the moment, the bark is gray, so I don't anticipate sunburn problems on a suddenly exposed plant like that. And I can guarantee that a vigorous xylosma that has been pruned hard will resprout very quickly. And
Oh.
so my guess is it will be shading that bark in no time anyway. But in the case of a xylosma, I'm not real concerned about it.
If I had to paint a trunk like on a plum tree or something, do you paint the bark all the way around or just on the side, on the south side, southwest side?
There may be aesthetic reasons for painting it all the way around, but what matters is the part that's facing the direct sun at the hottest time of day. So you could just paint that side if that concerned you. Typically, people will paint the whole thing and they go up to the first branch. I'm especially concerned with fruit trees and things related to fruit trees. And what happens with a fruit tree, as an example, if you didn't thin your fruit enough and a whole branch breaks out, suddenly an interior part of the tree is exposed to direct sun. And of course, if it's breaking out because the fruit is ripening, that means it's midsummer, which is a really bad time of year to have that happen. And that's probably the most common instance of interior wood getting sunburned. Once it gets sunburned, the sunburn itself is not great. It damages the cambium. The plant can recover. But we know that borers, shot hole borers, and peach tree borers are very strongly attracted to injured, broken wood. But I remember going to a whole long seminar on borers, and they would go out to a site. These are borer researchers, would get a call that there'd been a break or something. They'd go out to the site. Within 24 hours, they would typically find multiple points of entry where borers had come along and begun to infest the tree. So it's a very rapid reaction to that kind of injury. And it almost always ca is caused, in the case of fruit trees, by limb breakage in midsummer. If you have to prune it, definitely paint it. If a limb breaks and you see interior wood suddenly exposed, you definitely should paint that. Even if it's higher up on the tree, getting up and whitewashing it can actually save the tree. What happens if you don't? It's kind of the beginning of a slow process of decline. You'll get the sunburn, you'll get borers in there. The next person who comes in to prune your tree will point them out to you and say, this whole branch needs to come out. It may be a quarter or a third of the tree. That opens up more areas to possible sunburn. So it becomes, just as I say, a steady decline. Yes, you can harvest for 3, 4, 5 more years as you slowly take that tree down one branch at a time, but it'd be better to prevent that in the first place with a quick whitewash, interior white latex. If you suddenly expose an interior of a fruit tree or anything related to that kind of fruit tree to direct sun, especially in the afternoon.
And even before that, you could help prevent it by thinning your peaches.
That would be
Put
good,
those
yes.
branches back so they
And
don't break.
one of the things about summer pruning, people have asked, will you talk about summer pruning? You're pruning it pretty hard in the summer. Yeah, but what you're doing is you're making it more hedge-like. So you're actually making it kind of a bushier habit in the long run. The main thing is we're in a very hot climate. We get extreme heat events every summer. We get over 100 degrees 10, 20 times, depending from summer to summer. It's as little as 5 1 year and as much as 40 times 1 year. We expect that will increase. Those heat waves can be very harmful to a plant if there's direct heat on wood that was not previously exposed. So it's important to keep that in mind as you're pruning, thinning, or when that horrible thing occurs where the branch was just close to harvest. And so you let it stay. You didn't prop it up, and you go out one day and it's split, and suddenly interior wood is exposed to direct sunlight. So when you buy a bare root tree, hopefully the nursery will remember. Half the time we don't remember. Hopefully the nursery will remember to tell you to paint it or protect it at the time of planting to prevent sunburn.
So, what listeners might not know is that when we record this show, we get on together, like 20 minutes, half an hour before, and we're looking at the messages and the things we want to cover and looking at this and that. Then every once in a while, Don will just send over a picture like he did today, beautiful picture. And he pointed out the peach leaf curl that was on that thing, even though it wasn't a peach, it was a nectar something.
Nectar plum. Nectar
Okay,
plum. Yeah.
but it got the nectarine genes, and so it
Right.
gets peach leaf curl. And he said, and this one, unfortunately, is subject to thrips. And I went, thrips? What the heck is thrips? So
What is
Don,
that? What
what
are
the heck is thrips?
Yes, well, first of all, thrips is one of those things like deer where it's both singular and plural. So you refer to a thrips or a bunch of thrips. They're all the same. And nectarines in particular, the picture I sent was nectar plum, the spice Z nectar plum, which is one of these wonderful interspecific hybrids that Dave Wilson Nursery sells. Floyd Zager's company developed these. You've heard of pluots, that's a plum apricot. You've heard of apriums, that's an apricot plum. And this is the nectar plum. And it's delicious, actually. It's one of our favorite fruit because it literally is intermediate in almost every characteristic between a nectarine and a plum. And so you have the sprightly texture of the plum and the flavor of the sweet flavor of the nectarine and so forth. But the problem that we do have with nectarines here, and I want people to know this, and it's unique to them, not peaches, is the Western flower thrips, which is a native insect that attacks many crop plants, many non-native crop plants, will move from the grasses in your field or in your garden onto nectarines just at the stage of fruit set. And they get on there right as the fruit has, right when there's petals on the ground and the blossom has been pollinated and the little tiny fruit is forming, you can start to see the damage from thrips before the fruit is even thumbnail size. And what they do, they have a rasping feeding mouth part. And so they get in there and they feed and it leaves a scar, just a little scurfy scar on the smooth skin of the nectarine or the nectar plum. They do not get on plums, in my experience, or apricots or peaches because they're fuzzy. They just happen to like nectarines and fruit that's sort of like a nectarine, like the nectar plum. And as the fruit goes into the expansion phase, those scarred areas don't expand properly. So the fruit buckles and it gets all distorted and it looks awful. It's perfectly edible, as your mom would say. It's perfectly good. There's nothing wrong with it, but it looks bad. And if it's all really buckled, you get those areas there where they're kind of squeezed together, squished together. You're going to get earwigs in there and other problems. It's very frustrating because you can have as much as half of the fruit on your nectarine tree damaged by thrips to the point that you're not going to find it very appealing. Again, you can eat it, but it looks rough. Part of the, one way to manage that is you can see this injury on the fruit even before it's fully expanded. So as you're thinning fruit, which you should do, so the fruit is all one fist apart, remember that rule, all down the stem, look for the ones that are injured, break them off when you're doing your fruit thinning. But it can be a lot of the fruit. I have some varieties where it just seems like 80% of the fruit is just distorted that way. The one spray that you can do that might help with this is to spray the tree with an oil, either a summer strength version of a dormant oil, or neem would probably work because it's a light oil. Spray it on the tree about when that fruit has first set. So when it's done blooming and the fruit is there but hasn't fully expanded, spraying the tree to just protect it from the thrips as they would be landing. The oil itself works as just a sticky residue. They land and they're killed by that. The neem acts both as a smothering agent and also as to some degree as a repellent. Both of these will affect the beneficials to some degree as you spray. If there's a ladybug on there when you spray with oil, it's not going to be real good for the ladybug. So this is something to keep in mind. But they're actually very low toxicity materials in general, safe to use, and can help with the thrips. The reason I mention it now, the timing is March. So important to get that done once the fruit has set and is getting ready to start expanding. Thrips can be frustrating on a lot of other things we grow. They're very exasperating on some of our summer vegetables and so forth. Generally, the harm they do is cosmetic, but they can be a lot of them because they are, as I say, a native pest that's living on the grasses in the winter and moving in as you mow down the grasses. So spraying for thrips in general, not much point in that, but spraying to protect the cosmetic appearance of your nectarines might be worth the effort.
And if you don't have a problem with your nectarines, or if it's only affecting, 10% of the fruit,
Yeah.
then maybe the harm from spraying oil, the harm to the beneficials, might not be worth it. So if this is your first year getting a nectarine, I'd say let's see what it looks like before you start spraying on birthday.
Yeah, don't rush to it. But what you might want to do is start looking more closely at the fruit as it's developing. And as you see, if you see certain fruit that already have this darker scarring on them, just break those off. There's generally speaking, nectarines and plums set way more fruit than you should allow to come to harvest. You should be thinning them out. I use that one fist apart rule, which is a pretty good one. You should have your peaches and nectarines thin so they're not touching. Anywhere they're touching, you tend to get bugs in there. That's one of the issues. And so you just take your fist and you make sure that they're, one fist apart down the branch. And that usually removes about half of the fruit anyway. You're typically removing, not only have you pruned to remove about half the fruiting wood or more, you're then going to remove about half the fruit when it sets in a normal year. That's the part most people don't do. And by the way, it's okay to do that by pruning. Many people are concerned about this. It's perfectly, you can go out and knock off fruit, break them off, or you can go out and shorten up branches and prune off some portions of the tree. It doesn't hurt the tree to do some pruning. I really want people to understand you can prune your fruit trees just about any time for one reason or another. There are different consequences for pruning at different times, but I've seen people thinning fruit trees by thinning wood that has fruit on it, or just by getting up there and breaking it off with their thumb, whatever works best for you. If you don't, you'll have a lot more fruit, it'll be smaller, and there's a pretty high likelihood that some of the branches will break.
All right, well, let's go into our mailbag. And today we have a message from Mime, who says, "Hi, Don and Lois. Hope you are doing well. Mm-hmm. It never occurred to me until today if we can plant lentils. I love to eat legumes and lentils in our family. Can we grow lentils in zone 9 or 9B? That's San Jose. Mm-hmm. And if so, what varieties would you recommend? I tried searching online, but there isn't much information on how to plant lentils in these zones. Also, where to buy them is limited. Okay, tell me what you can."
I'll get back to you about information about varieties. You're right. There isn't that much information out there. It's a traditional staple food, thousands of years of usage. In general, plants in the pea and bean family like mild weather. I'll make that big generalization. Some of them like mild warm weather. Some of them like mild colder weather. And it's in the mild colder weather category, like fava beans. So here in zone 9A, 9B, we plant them typically in the fall or winter to harvest before it gets real hot. By the way, I'm going to go back to that generalization. Beans prefer the milder weather. We're talking about just green beans or beans that you're using for fresh eating like that. And they are best to plant when they'll be producing before we get extremely hot here. This is an experience many people have in the Sacramento Valley, is planting green beans in April and getting great results in June, but planting green beans in May or June and they grow like crazy and they flower and nothing happens. They don't set properly. And then they plant them again in August, September, and they get a great crop of beans in the fall. So beans, green beans, are generally grown in the milder ends of our summer here. And if you've had that experience and you're wondering why you never got good beans in July, it's because it's just plain too hot for them here to set well. They'll grow fine, but they won't set well. So you can leave them, you can battle the black aphid that you're going to get all summer, or you can just wait and plant them in late summer for fall harvest. It is one thing you can be planting now in your vegetable garden in the month of March. You can plant beans, green beans, but lentils are more like peas. Lentils and fava beans, which are cool season, and garden peas, snow peas, snap peas, and the kind that we use for shelling are all planted in the milder, cool end of the season. So here in Northern California, we start planting them in October. You can plant them all the way into early February, and then you're generally harvested and done by the end of April or early May. In a good year where we don't get hot early, you can harvest all the way through May. Otherwise, you're typically done right about tomato planting and pepper planting season. In fact, peas and peppers are great alternates because the peas are done in early May. You're picking the last of them. You're ready to pull them out. And then it's a great time to plant your peppers and eggplant, perhaps in that same bed that you've now enriched by growing peas there, since they do fix nitrogen in the soil. So lentils are in that category. Cool season. And again, as for varieties, I'll see if I can find some information for you about which ones are best. But it is, unfortunately, here in Northern California, it's late, in my opinion, to plant lentils. We just said all that stuff about beans. If you're growing beans for dried beans, don't worry about it. pinto beans, all those cool, you know, heirloom beans that you might be growing. I can do a bunch of them this year just for fun. We grow those here in the summer. They grow fine. They set well. They're somewhat more heat tolerant. They set midsummer. You're letting them dry basically on the vine, and then you're saving them to use as dried beans. Those do fantastically here. This is an area where beans are grown commercially for sale. There are farmers locally who grow pinto beans, cannelli beans, and a number of others. And those are planted just like a normal summer crop.
And that's probably why she was asking about lentils, because lentils, if you ever go to the store and you buy a bag of lentils, what you'll see is the perfect half spheres, because there were two of them together and they split apart just like split peas.
Yep.
But they're dry. They're not something that I'm going to munch fresh.
Yeah, you would be harvesting those April to May, and you'd be storing them and using them on through the summer and winter. So not all hard to grow, but I think it's late to do them now. Same thing came up with garbanzo beans. Same thing. They prefer the cooler end of the season.
So I want an announcement here. If you are interested in lentils, peas, beans, all that kind of stuff, there is an organization called the USA Pulses, P-U-L-S-E-S. And it's folks who are really into this, you know, the legumes. And they have all sorts of training and introductions and stuff like that. I'm in the lentils, and there's like seven chapters of the thing about what it is, its general properties, how do you produce it, how do you process it, how do you apply it, non-traditional applications, functional, and you know, all this stuff. It's great.
Pulses.org.
No, USAPulses.org.
Okay. Pulse, P-U-L-S-E, is simply a term that refers to edible members of the legume family. So it's all the beans and the lentils and the vetches and the lupins and things like that.
Lupins are edible?
It says so on here, but you know what? I'm not going to go with that.
I'm not going to go with that either. Okay. Let's get...
Go ahead.
And let's get back to the messages we've gotten in. Josh, who is in Davis, says, "Hi, Don and Lois. I love the show. We're looking for some lesser known dwarf fruit trees or bushes that we can plant in large pots or troughs. We already have a dwarf nectarine and want something a little more interesting than a Meyer lemon. Okay. Any recommendations for unusual or underappreciated fruiting plants that would do well in containers in Davis?"
Assuming the container is big enough, that's the first thing. That we do get this question a lot. Folks who, you know, either are renting and not going to stay in the place for long enough to have, you know, to plant a tree in the ground, or simply don't have room in the ground to plant a tree, they're looking for something miniature. And a very similar parallel conversation came up with someone looking for a fruit tree or bush for a schoolyard. Okay. And these are two separate issues, but they kind of overlap. Rangpur lime is another citrus that's similar to a Meyer lemon that's easy to grow in a container. Rangpur lime is a sour orange that is used like a lime. Calamondin, or calamansi, as they call it in the Philippines, is another sour orange, extremely prolific, very beautiful plant, by the way, very attractive ornamental, and it has a sour orange that we use as we use Meyer lemons and limes. It's another one that's used the same way, but a little flavor more towards the mandarin orange end of the spectrum, but tart, very tart, but quite aromatic. And again, it's one of these plants, like Meyer lemon, that has fruit hanging on it all the time. It's one of those ones where the fruit holds on the tree well, so you can have fruit that was ripe 6 months ago still hanging on there perfectly good as a new fruit is developing. And likewise, kumquats are very ornamental plants that you can do in a container. You've already mentioned the dwarf nectarine. Of course, there are dwarf peaches as well as dwarf nectarines. There's a dwarf mulberry, which is pretty cool. That is a most mulberries are big. Mulberry trees range from 15 to 40 feet, and some of them reseed like crazy. So if you're thinking, I like a mulberry, do a little research before you just grab a mulberry. Some of them are way too big for the average resident. Others are relatively small. I have black mulberries on my property that are only 12 by 12, still be too big for a container, but there's a dwarf mulberry, and that's all it's labeled. It comes in from one of my growers. Dwarf mulberry appears to be Morris nigra, one of the black mulberries, could easily be kept in a barrel. Mulberries are pretty cool because they ripen over a surprisingly long period of time. Much like figs, they will start flowering and fruiting in early summer. In the case of figs, there's an early crop. In the case of mulberries, it's like June, and you can continue to pick them all the way into August. So you have a very long ripening period. The downside of mulberries is the vast majority of them stain like crazy. So where the fruit falls, it makes a purple stain. When you pick them, your fingers get covered with it. If kids are picking them, more than just their fingers are likely to get covered with it, and it doesn't go away very easily. So put them where that won't matter. But other than that, it's one of the easiest plants to grow. The biggest issue you'll have is fighting off the birds and other animals that like to eat mulberries when you want them. In the case of a dwarf one, you can cover the tree. So you could put netting over it or something like that. But mulberries are quite easy as well. Back to the citrus, the lime that's used in Thai cooking has a bunch of different names. Kefir lime is the most common name I'm seeing on it, or makrut lime. It's grown for the leaves. And very, very easy to grow. And as you cut it to use the foliage in Thai cooking, it bushes out and makes a very attractive plant. It does fruit. The fruit's interesting. It's a lumpy, funny looking thing with a considerable zest. It's one of those things that's real aromatic. And so the zest can also be used in cooking. And that could easily be grown in a container. So there's lots of little woody plants that could certainly be grown as edibles for the fruit. And of course, you know, kitchen herbs like rosemary are great in containers as well. The main thing is make sure your container is big enough. I can't think how you'd be able to manage any of these in anything smaller than a half barrel. Livestock troughs are great because they're even more soil volume. So something that holds at least 3 cubic feet of soil would be the, and that's what basically what a half wine barrel holds, 3.5 cubic feet of soil. And then the other key issue is the type of soil that you use. If this is going to be a fairly permanent plant in a container, I always, for my woody plants in containers, I always use a more mineral-based soil. In the case of our nursery, that's going to be our citrus and palm mix. If you're at shopping at another place, it might be their cactus mix because it's going to have more sand, pumice, things that are permanent in there. If you just use their fancy or our fancy soil that's made for tomatoes and flowers and things like that, that's going to break down and drop 2 to 4 inches in the course of the growing season and just slowly disintegrate. And you'll have to do something about that at some point down the road because compost breaks down, but minerals don't. And so if you start with a base of a primarily mineral soil, citrus and palm mix, cactus mix, something like that, and then mix in some of that enriched soil or top dress with some of that enriched soil to feed the plant, then that will manage the plant's nutrients and help retain moisture, but you won't be constantly losing soil volume due to the decomposition of the organic portion. So choose your soil carefully, make a big container, and of course, you'll probably be watering nearly daily in the summer here with a woody plant in a container, at least by the second summer. As long as you do all that, it's pretty easy to grow a lot of these things in containers. The livestock troughs are proving to be a very handy way for people to go. Just don't forget to take the plug out before you fill it with soil.
So you talked a lot about citrus, but he's got a dwarf nectarine. Mm-hmm. What about having a dwarf, I don't know, peach, apricot, plum? Do they make dwarf things like that?
They did. They tried. The dwarfing characteristic of very tight internode distance occurred first in peaches and nectarines, or was bred into peaches and nectarines from a naturally occurring form. It's not genetically modified except in the sense of hybridization. And there were attempts to get that into apricots and apples and cherries. And I remember all those in the 1980s when all these came on the market. Almost all of those reverted pretty quickly. So none of them remained dwarf, unfortunately. Yes, there was a dwarf apricot called Garden Annie. There was a dwarf apple and so forth. With apples, you can, especially if you're living in a climate where apples are you know, more suitable, you can find them on very dwarfing rootstocks. And this is a case, one of the rare cases where the rootstock really does make a difference as to the ultimate size of the tree. There are rootstocks for apples that keep them as little bushes. There are rootstocks that allow you to train them as colonnade or very narrow growth habit. That characteristic was also bred into some. Apples are unique in that regard. As for all the others, not really. There's not a dwarf plum, dwarf apricot, dwarf, you know, and so on. There's peaches and nectarines are the two that are what they used to call genetic dwarf trees. Now they call them miniature trees, and they basically turn into a shrub. They're really cool, actually. They're a really easy way to get a good quality. They're not 10 on a scale of 1 to 10, but they're 7, you know, they're good fruit. And it's on a thing that's a shrub. My customers who planted them 20, 30 years ago, I've seen a couple of those. They're 6 by 6 and they don't have to prune them at all. Yeah, they get leaf curl. They spray for that, or they don't worry about it, whatever the case. The fruit is nearly full size, if not completely full size. And it's good. It's very good. And they're very pretty when they're in bloom. The first ones that were introduced were actually very showy flowers. That was like their primary selling point. Bonanza is a good example of a variety that came out in the 1970s. Really pretty in bloom. The fruit was okay. I would consider it kind of mediocre. But Honey Babe, Pix Z, Necta Z, some of the ones that the Dave Wilson Nursery has introduced from Floyd Zager's breeding programs are outstanding fruit on a plant that's basically a shrub. And that gets to the question about a tree for a school. When people want to plant fruit trees at
Well,
school.
before we go back to that, let's finish up with Josh because he said a fruit tree or bush. So we can put a blueberry in there, couldn't we?
Yes, blueberries are great in containers, and I've done them in barrels. Now, bear in mind that a blueberry typically gets about the size of a rose bush. So it seems to be a parallel that most people can relate to. They range from 3 to 6 feet, but most of them are about 4 foot. One blueberry will fill a barrel, an oak barrel, one plant, and will produce very, very well for you. 2 to 3 can go into a larger livestock trough. I've done this. I planted 3 in a 6 foot by 2 foot by 3 foot deep livestock trough. And that gave me a little cross pollination, which enhances the fruit size. That's really the only reason for doing it. And they all did well. And I made sure no one of them overshadowed the others. And they give more blueberries than we know what to do with. So that's a pretty simple way to deal with it, is put them together in a livestock trough. The more soil volume you have, the better. When you're looking at that little blueberry plant at the garden center, which is in a 1 gallon can, and thinking, I can keep this in a 5 gallon. No, it needs, it's a big plant with a big root system, but it's a shrub. So it's a very good choice. My experience with blueberries is I get the best yield when I put them in full sun, but the plants look better if they're in light shade. So you choose whether aesthetics are more of a concern to you than the volume of fruit. The one thing about them is they're never, ever drought tolerant. So put a system in, like a drip system that waters them every couple days during the summertime. I use micro sprayers, but drippers are fine as long as they cover the soil area evenly. That's where that Netafim type might be ideal, with the emitterized tubing sort of running in a loop around the plants. You may need to run it daily. I have one customer who's been growing blueberries for years in large tubs, large planters, and he runs his system every day for 6 minutes. He measured the output on his system. He watched it. It went all the way through, was draining out the bottom in 6 minutes. So he finds 6 minutes a day, keeps the plants perfectly healthy, and he gets plenty of blueberries. His are planted where they get afternoon shade, morning sun, which seems to be just about ideal in terms of the appearance of the plant and maintaining adequate yield. So blueberries, we used to think of as something we couldn't grow in California, and especially with hard water and things like that. Southern high bush hybrids that have come on the market are incredibly easy to grow. There's probably 10 varieties that are going to be, you can find at almost any garden center nowadays. And even in Southern California, Sunshine Blue only needs 100 chilling hours and is being grown in San Diego County. So there are blueberries for any part of the state, and that would be a great choice because it's a shrub rather than a tree. You can manage them for several years in a container with no problem, as long as you give them the water and the occasional nutrient update that they need. By the way, with respect to that, when I'm growing woody plants in containers, I'm about to go around and do this right now. I take our most enriched potting soil that we sell. It's called Recipe 420, for those of you in the know what that comes from. And it's got extra bat guano and seabird guano and high nitrogen. I just scoop a bunch of that on top of the planter. I just put an inch or two, I mulch my container plants with our enriched potting soil. It doesn't take much, but it gives them what they need for the whole season. And then with a blueberry, it shades the roots and protects them from drying out because they have very fine roots that can be damaged if they dry out. So beginning of the irrigation season, that's a great time. Put another inch or two of enriched potting soil on top of the root system in your container.
All right. Then we were going to talk about the schools
Yeah.
wanting to have child size fruit.
That,
That's
yeah.
a good thing.
Yeah, it came in. First question was, do you have any leaf curl resistant peaches? Because they wanted to plant it in the school and they wouldn't be able to spray it. And I said, they exist, but don't worry about it. Just don't spray them. They'll still flower and fruit just fine. For those of you who care, yes, there are 3 or 4 peach varieties that have been introduced for peach leaf curl resistance. But I said, peaches ripen July and August.
And the kids aren't there.
The custodial staff will really appreciate them, but there aren't very many kids there. She said, yeah, good point. So you might want to look for a fruit that ripens during the school year, which means either September, yeah, there are some peaches that ripen in September, or June, some peaches that ripen in June, but those honestly aren't the best of them. How about if we think about something that's more likely to ripen and actually hold on the tree? Because another issue with peaches and stone fruits in general, they're ripe that day they fall, they're squishy and gross. And I don't think that the school grounds really want, 100, 200, 500 peaches rotting on the ground underneath the tree. I think in general, if you're looking at a schoolyard, citrus is going to be a much better choice because citrus are pretty carefree here in California. And some of them can become trees, but others are more like a bush. And again, what you just got at, kids scale. You know, planting a tree that kids are going to climb to get at the fruit, not a good plan. Planting a tree that you've kept down to where someone can walk up and pick the fruit, which you could do with citrus, or you can do with miniature peaches and nectarines if you happen to be planning for summer harvest, that keeps it at the scale that's appropriate. And they're much lower input. You know, there's a lot of things you really kind of need to do to manage peaches and nectarines on a normal basis. And that even goes for plums and apricots and others. There's pruning that has to happen every year for the next 15 to 20 years, not just the year that you had an interest in this project or that a school teacher had an interest in it, but not perpetuity, but at least a decade plus, you're making work for the school ground staff. But not if you plant something like a mandarin or a navel orange, or a lemon tree, they're kind of thorny, but you also keep that in mind in the case of the lemons, or something miniature like a peach that at least they'd enjoy the blossoms and maybe their summer school. Maybe they'll enjoy the bloom during the fruit during summer school. That would be the direction I would go.
The other thing about citrus is that they're evergreen. They're mm-hmm. not deciduous yeah. plants. And so in the winter when school's in session and you've got that bare little fruit tree out there, that can be kind of disappointing, yeah. but the citrus, not only is it evergreen, but it has a more, some of them have a more than 1 year cycle. So you get the flowers and then you get the little fruit. And by the time the fruit is ripening, you've got more flowers.
Yeah, the flowers in the spring. And there are some that flower off and on, like Meyer lemon. It can flower any time of year. Kumquats flower in the summer rather than in the spring. And in the case of those two, they set fruit that hangs on the tree for a full year. So you can go out and pick pretty much anytime it looks ripe, you can pick it and it can hang on there if you don't happen to get to picking it. So I just think they're better choices for the lower management, the lower input, make sure they're going to get deep watered every now and then. The thing to keep in mind is every school is supposed to have a garden in California. By law, actually, it's state law. They're supposed to have a garden. They don't have any funds for it. They aren't given any resources, but they're all supposed to have a garden. And this is very heavily promoted. It doesn't have to be a full, extensive, you know, community garden type of thing, but they're supposed to have some sort of horticultural learning experience, hands-on, preferably out there. Garden centers are almost always willing to donate or help with things like that. Service clubs and organizations are often willing to help with it. And even Tree Davis, I'm on the board. One of the grants that we got, which is a schoolyard planting thing, the grant stipulated that we were supposed to include fruit trees. So the staff sent me a note saying, fruit trees in schoolyards, what would you recommend? Well, it's the same conversation we just had. The lowest input, longest harvest season, things that have, you know, different seasons of bloom and harvest and so forth, and don't make work for the custodial staff or for people who didn't buy into this. It is a well-run school garden. You've got groups of parents that come in and do things. There's one in South Davis. It's a model for this, Pioneer Elementary School. And they take care of their class's garden that year, and then they hand it off to that same class next year. But, you know, the same third grade teacher will now be in charge of it with parents the next year and so forth. They have a system in place. Other schools, it's like a whole bunch of parents get involved. They plant a bunch of stuff. It gets watered automatically. That's it. And those tend not to succeed, but at least they've had the learning experience. If you're going to stick a fruit tree into something like that, make sure it's extremely low maintenance. And that would be a citrus or a fig or a pomegranate or a persimmon, but also bear in mind the fruit litter issue. Getting back to the first question that Josh asked, a fig is a good example of something that you can get a very small variant. Violette de Bordeaux, Blackjack, Little Miss Figgy, that's a new one, things like that, that are dwarf figs that produce figs. The schoolyard, figs are kind of messy. I don't know if I would do that. But for Josh doing something in a container, there are figs that are easy to grow in pots.
So Don, when you were talking about citrus, you mentioned one that you said, but this has thorns. Mm-hmm. Now, here's my question about a tree that has thorns. Can I go and snip off the pointed parts of the stuff on the trunk? And will it stay snipped off or will it regrow a point on the thorns? And are the thorns only on the trunk or are they on the fruit and the leaves and stuff like that?
Fortunately, they're not on the fruit. That would be very awkward. The citrus in particular are a good example. Citrus Some of them are thorny. Lemons in general, not Meyer lemons, but true lemons like Eureka and Lisbon lemon, even the part that you're harvesting fruit from has spines, has short thorns. And they're painful and uncomfortable to deal with. Most citrus, like oranges and mandarins, if a shoot has come up that has thorns on it, it's probably juvenile or a root stock. And that's important to know. Any citrus, with the exception of, well, a couple of the ones we've mentioned already, Meyer lemons and Rangpur limes and such, those are on their own roots. They're typically not grafted. Sometimes they are, usually not. They just root those and sell them. Almost all other citrus that you buy, mandarin, a navel orange, it's the Washington navel has been grafted onto a rootstock. The rootstocks tend to be very thorny. And if the shoot comes up from below the graft, you'll recognize it right away. It'll have different leaves. Typically, they're a three-part leaf in many cases, and they have distinct, visible, and rather painful thorns. That's a good sign to you to follow that back down on the trunk to where it arises and cut it off completely. And once you do that, the tree will not have thorns again. Sometimes a citrus tree, like a navel orange, will send up a vigorous shoot from above the graft. A water sprout, that's called. And it's not a sucker, technically, you know, the way we use the term. A sucker refers to one that comes from the rootstock. Water sprout comes from above the graft. It is, however, juvenile wood. Citrus have hormonal changes as they go from seedling to mature. And the seedlings are thorny and have angular stems. The mature wood is not thorny and does not have angular stems, but every now and then a shoot will come up that's juvenile. Commercially, they'll typically remove those because they'll take 3 to 5 years before they mature and ever make fruit. Home gardeners tend to remove them because they're thorny as heck and they're really uncomfortable to work around. They are the same thing you planted if it's above the graft, but you may wish to remove it because it's just so awkward to have in the tree with those thorns on it. Again, just trace it down to where it arises from the stem, see whether it's coming from above or below the graft. That'll tell you one important data point. But if it's thorny and vigorous and angular with extra large leaves, that's juvenile wood almost for sure, and that should be removed. Sometimes you leave it because it'll balance the tree shape or something, but bear in mind that it's going to be quite a while before that branch makes fruit. There's an actual hormonal phase change it has to go through before it will start to flower and fruit.
We always close our show with a saying or a thought or something. Here I have one that says, if life insists on giving you rocks, make a rock garden.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.
On Wednesdays, 6 to 7 p.m., it's Sounds So Sweet, where host Wayne Hagen takes a lively look at the sweet sounds of jug band music, past and present. Wayne is a founding member of the California Jug Band Association. He's been playing jug since 1979. He says that getting a chance to share his love for jug band music on KDRT is a great joy. That's Sounds So Sweet, Wednesdays at 6 p.m. right here on KDRT, and it replays during the week. So for the rebroadcast times, just check out the schedule guide.